Canada Elections 2025 Fund. Tune in live on April 28th for our election night coverage and visit altelxn.ca for more information.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Isabella Garrido, Jaya Kumar, and Abyaz Karim. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. At their April 15th meeting, Council unanimously voted to explore creative social investment options to tackle the housing and homelessness crisis. According to data from the City of Kingston, as of January 2025, 503 individuals are experiencing homelessness in the Kingston community, and more are precariously housed. The city currently has a goal of creating 480 affordable housing and supportive housing units by the end of 2026. With an eye towards sustainable development and greater civic engagement, the city is exploring the use of community bonds as a tool to fund affordable housing initiatives. The motion states it is looking to encourage residents and local organizations to invest directly in community projects, while ensuring that the financial benefits, such as interest payments, remain within the community. The city's chief financial officer, Desiree Kennedy, explained what this could look like for the city before council.
The community bonds, so they are a type of social bond, and they are used generally to, the focus of them is generally to have a return that's more around social or environmental impact, so some sort of a positive social impact. They are a community bond in that they do focus on community engagement as opposed to, say, a municipality just going and issuing a bond and doing something. This is about the community being engaged and coming up with solutions, one of which would be a community bond. The other thing is that they tend to be smaller values so that public can participate and be part of what the solution is. They have been used, there's actually a couple of housing examples within Ontario where they've been used. They generally are issued by a not-for-profit or a charity organization, not always by a municipality, though I know the City of Toronto does issue social bonds for various things, but they tend to be more issued through a community. I'm not as familiar, and I think part of this research will be the process around it and how that works, what the interest rate might look like, and potentially it could be a little bit of a lower interest rate if investors are willing to give up some rate in terms of seeing that the impact happening from the bond.
Community bond utilization can be found throughout the province. Examples including Toronto's Social Debenture Program, Kensington Market Community Land Trust, and Haliburton County's Places for People. Kennedy also noted that the city will most likely not incur extra administrative costs.
I think that's part of the research that we will do. I don't see it. I think potentially it would be another entity that would be working to issue those bonds. There is actually a company in Toronto that helps to assist smaller entities with respect to issuing these types of bonds as well. And that's part of the research we will do, is to reach out and have a conversation with them. But certainly, sort of at first glance, without doing more research, I really don't see it as being something that would be a cost administrative to the city.
Councillor Connie Glenn, who sits on the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee, motivated the motion, a task that has been in the works for quite some time, according to Councillor Jeff McLaren.
I just want to bring attention to the fact that you were leading this community bond thing through the Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. It's something that we've been trying to do for almost two terms now, and you got it done. So thank you very much for your leadership on this.
Staff will provide the Housing and Homelessness Committee and Council with an information report by the third quarter of 2025 with best practices for social investment options. At their last meeting, Council received an update on the Integrated Care Hub and approved $500,000 to keep their shelter services up and running. The Integrated Care Hub is located at 661 Montreal Street, supported by a group of organizations,
Addiction and Mental Health Services, Kingston Frontenac Clinics in Addington, Kingston Community Health Centers, Providence Care, Trellis HIV and Community Care, and Homebase Housing. The ICH provides low-barrier services to individuals in need, including a place to rest, meals, and harm reduction supplies. After the September 2024 incident, where two people were killed in the area surrounding the hub and the nearby Bell Park encampment, Councillor Gregory Ridge proposed the ICH present a security and safety plan and form a community consultation group to continue receiving funding from the city. In addition to these conditions, which were met by the ICH, the motion asked city staff to compile a report with information and safety metrics related to the operation of the integrated care hub. This report was presented to council at their April 15th meeting. Councillor Ridge noted the steep increase in emergency services since the establishment of the ICH in a question to the city's Commissioner of Community Services, Jennifer Campbell.
So I want to start by saying, you know, based on the data tables and the reports that are contained therein, there's a lot to parse there. But I'm going to start with, based on the data that's presented in the report and any data that may be available to staff with regards to increases in emergency response throughout the city, are there any other areas of the city that have a 176% increase in fire response, a 313% increase in paramedic response, or a 372% increase in police response from 2020 to 2021?
Commissioner Campbell, go ahead.
Thank you, and through you, there is not.
However, Ridge also noted the important care the ICH has provided to the community's most vulnerable residents, including their crucial food program.
But I do also want to highlight from the report, there were over 38,000 meals served in 2020. There were over 39,000 served in 2021, just shy of that. So, yeah, I think that this is a step in the right direction.
588 unique individuals accessed ICH services from April 1st, 2024 to January 31st, 2025. The report also included a recommendation from a 2022 third-party review of the ICH that select services should be spread out across Kingston. Councillor Tozo underscored what control the city has in terms of ushering in suggested changes.
One of the recommendations was that some of these services put together can cause some exaggerated challenges for the area. And some of the recommendations are separating some of these services out, if I'm reading the report correctly. The other challenge I'm just trying to figure out is we don't control these services. It's a consortium of partners. I just want to get this on the public record. The city is one small player in a much larger consortium of agencies that are there, and this is provincially funded for the major services.
The conversation around the horseshoe is short, but the community consultation group, which includes neighbors, business owners, community service providers, ICH service providers, and councillors, plans to discuss the new information in more detail, according to Councillor Gregory Ridge. Council unanimously approved the allocation of $500,000 specifically to support shelter operations at the Integrated Care Hub until March 31, 2026. The ICH provided 619 overnight stays in their rest zone in January 2025 alone. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, folks. I'm Abhyas from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Here we bring you the latest updates from Queen's Campus. When you hear the word supercomputer, you might picture a giant machine in a secret lab, but they're already changing our everyday lives. This evening on Campus Corner, we are joined by Dr. Ryan Grant, assistant professor at Queen's University and a global expert in high-performance computing. From climate predictions to artificial intelligence, we will unpack what supercomputing really is, why it matters, and how Canada and Queens fit into the global picture. Hello, Dr. Grant. Thank you for joining us in our studio this evening. How are you doing this evening?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for asking. So let's start with the basics. When people hear the word supercomputer, they might picture a massive machine crunching numbers in some high-tech lab. But what exactly is supercomputing, and why does it matter for everyday people?
It's a great question. So supercomputing is the fundamental idea that you can take existing smaller computers and use them together to do something collaboratively. So supercomputers themselves are referred to as capability machines. Mm-hmm. The idea here is that by hooking many different computers together with special networks and special equipment, that we can have multiple computers work on the same problem to solve them far faster than an individual computer could do it. Now, there are other supercomputers in spaces that one would consider super. They're very, very large, that do things like serve your Google search to you and things like that. Those are what we call capacity systems. They work on a whole bunch of different independent tasks that are all fairly small and not interrelated. What we're talking about with capability systems, though, is making many different computers work on one big, gigantic task. So an example of these things include modeling the entire world's climate over many years, doing your weather prediction in time for the weather for the next day, doing training for large language models like ChatGPTs of the world, solving solutions for understanding if there's going to be a tsunami warning after there's an earthquake out in the water. Supercomputers provide us new capabilities because we're able to process problems that are either too large for an individual computer to do or that don't complete in time. So let's give an example of this. What does this really mean? A supercomputer, one of the top supercomputers in the world, can do in a day what it would take your high-powered, good quality laptop about 7 years to do.
Wow.
That's if the problem would actually fit on your laptop. It would never actually fit on your laptop because it's way too big. It would never fit in the memory that's in your laptop. But it gives you an idea of the supercomputing power in that space. And we get there by hooking together tens of thousands of commercial-grade servers all at the same time with very special supercomputing networks.
Right. Great. So I did some research about the G7 countries and where Canada stands. So I see that Canada is falling behind the global supercomputing race, ranking below the other G7 nations. What's holding us back? And what would it take for us to compete with other world leaders like the US and China?
So Canada, because we are a smaller populace, will probably never have the aggregate computing power of China or the US. It would simply cost us too much per capita to do that. But we can, if you want to look at it in this way, the US and China will build multiple very large supercomputers. It's possible in Canada to build over time to building very large supercomputers as well. And we probably only need one of them. We don't need six of them like the US would, right? And that really puts us in contention on a per capita compute basis with everybody else in the world. Now, there's been some recent investments from the federal government in refreshing our existing research infrastructure for computing that's going to improve our numbers a little bit. And there's a much larger investment going on right now in AI infrastructure program from the federal government that's trying to inject enough money into the ecosystem such that we can get into the stratosphere of very large supercomputers in the world, top 10, top 20 type range of supercomputers. What's really held us back in the past is that we don't build big supercomputers. So building big supercomputers is hard, and you need a lot of very specialized talent to be able to do it.
Right.
I learned how to do it in the United States alongside many other colleagues. And for most of the big supercomputers that we were involved with that have used portions of our technology, we worked for many years with industry, vendors, other members of the government and academia to actually develop new technologies. So if you see a new top three supercomputer come out, you probably are seeing some sort of new first of its kind technology deployment or something that was new and invented specifically for that system. And a significant amount of time and effort and money went into all of that development for that supercomputer. So supercomputers really just push the envelope. It's kind of like an analogy would be, you know, Formula One racing versus your car, right? Technologies that are used in those really high-end racing competitions can also be eventually used in your car. Regenerative braking came from F1.
Right.
But now it's in your Toyota Prius, right? It's in your electric car that you drive everywhere. And so the same thing happens with high-performance computing. A lot of the technologies that we develop for supercomputers eventually trickle down to business computers or eventually potentially into commercial products that you would buy yourself as well. So we're just sort of the front edge of the technology curve in this space, and we invent the new things that are useful to the rest of the world 10 years from now.
Right. What I have understood is that supercomputers aren't just for scientists in lab coats. They're helping us solve real-world problems, from predicting extreme weather, like the tsunami example you gave, to advancing medical breakthroughs. So what are some of the most exciting ways supercomputers is shaping our future?
That is a very interesting question. So supercomputers touch your lives today. You don't even realize it, right? If you check the weather today, you used a supercomputer. If you chatted to ChatGPT, you used the output of a supercomputer. I think that supercomputers touch our lives when we need them to. So they either provide the ability to develop new green technologies. We saw recent advances with supercomputers and AI, where hundreds of years of equivalence of research was done on new mineral discovery in a matter of months. Mm. So at this point, we're starting to do massive amounts of research in a very short period of time. Practical elements to it become personalized medicine. The idea that in the future you could go into a hospital and that hospital will have supercomputing capabilities. They'll be able to take a look at you and model your entire body in as a digital twin and understand things like, if you had a early stage cancer and they were worried that it might metastasize and attach somewhere else, we can actually model how all of your blood cells move through your particular veins, figure out where those cancer cells might get quote unquote stuck in your circulatory system, so we can figure out where they might metastasize to, so we can monitor other sites in that space. Mm. We can do interesting things with understanding what climate change looks like over the long term and what the effects of those are. We can understand very finite detail in terms of earthquake modeling. In the example of earthquake simulation, our previous petascale systems were able to do things like model an earthquake and all of the buildings in the San Francisco Bay Area. And we could shake them all at the same time and we could see which ones were affected and which ones were in danger. But we were only capable of modeling the ground as ground. It was all dirt. It wasn't different layers of dirt. It was dirt, right, as a basic property. We didn't do layers of clay and layers of water and gravel and everything else.
Okay.
We moved to the exascale era. We were capable of modeling those different layers. This is work that other people did, of course. I'm not the applications earthquake person. But we were able to model the different layers on these larger systems so that we could understand how soils interacted with each other. And we actually found out in that case that unlike the petascale era where we thought very tall buildings were the number one building that was in danger, different areas of that Bay Area that would have median-sized buildings, not high-rises, but a reasonable number of stories, five or six stories, were actually even more in danger. It was partially due to the soil mixes they had underneath them that were worried about liquefacting when they shake. So you get new capabilities as you go from era to era to do things more and more in depth and more of them at the same time. I mean, the AI revolution that we have now today, LLMs, is not just smart people coming up with new ways to do things. It's also enabled by just sheer compute, right? You basically just take the internet and feed the entire internet into a language model and you get something useful at the other end. That's an awful lot of data and right. You need to be able to process those things. And that's really what supercomputing is getting us to in the future, is more and more capability to do more and more complex things and make the things that we could do in the previous eras inexpensive enough that we can start making them more broadly available to people to impact their lives.
Wonderful. Let's talk about Queen's. So at Queen's, how are students and researchers getting their hands on experience with supercomputers? And what role does the university play in introducing these young minds to the high-tech fields?
So that is an excellent question. So here at Queen's, we have access to several supercomputers throughout the national ecosystem here in Canada. And we also have, through, depending on the professor's lab, some relationships worldwide, through the US, Japan, Europe primarily, with collaborative agreements with them to be able to use this, some of their supercomputing capabilities as well. We collaborate with researchers that do supercomputing work, as well as all the sciences that need supercomputers to actually discover new things. So we've been training students in areas of things like molecular dynamics, materials, My particular lab teaches students how to build supercomputers, the architectures behind them. We improve the software that makes them work. We improve the networking stacks that make them able to be supercomputers in the first place. We develop new standards. Those standards get deployed worldwide, partially based on our work and partially based on the work of others, but we combine together into standards to make computers communicate better. And I also work a lot on leading a global effort of power monitoring and control on large supercomputers so we can make them operate in the most energy efficient ways possible. And that leads to either greater efficiency, so we're using electrons in better ways and we're doing more with them, and also the opportunities to be able to sort of turn things down and lessen our impact on the environment as well in that space. And sometimes you'll find that you actually do both of those things at the same time. That making things go much faster actually makes the overall impact of the system to be able to do a particular job much more green because we've been able to do it that much more effectively.
Right. Amazing. This actually brings us to the very end of our segment. Thank you, Dr. Grant. Thanks for being with us in studio tonight. But we have a lot more to talk about supercomputers. So as you have promised, you'll be with us in the next two episodes as well. We are eagerly looking forward to that. And that's a wrap, folks. I am Abhyas from CFRC News, and you are listening to our segment, Campus Corner. Stay tuned for more updates. Over to Isabella for sports after.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, April 23rd, looking like a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14 and it will be sunny and clear, dropping down to 5 overnight. Thursday, April 24th, we are going to see temperatures into the mid-teens with a daytime high of 15 degrees and a 30% chance of showers throughout the day, dropping down to 9 overnight. Friday, April 25th, it'll be cloudy but dry with a daytime high of 15 degrees, dropping down to 8 overnight with a 60% chance of precipitation. Saturday, April 26th, a little cooler, a little more rainy, high of 12 with a 40% chance of showers, dropping down to about 6 degrees overnight. Moving into Sunday, April 27th, we're going to have a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 14 and it will be sunny. And then starting the next week, Monday, April 28th, it'll be 14 and cloudy. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The heavy load restrictions are in effect in Kingston until April 22nd. Until then, heavy trucks and loads are restricted on city roads where posted. These restrictions help reduce damage to roads in the spring. A complete list of roads with restrictions can be found on the Traffic Bylaw section of the City of Kingston website. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians on the following dates. Saturday, May 3rd from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., Saturday, May 17th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., and Saturday, May 31st from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. During these periods, the removal of the modular bridge will begin at 6 a.m., with the marine channel expected to be open by 9 a.m. The marine channel will be closed at 5 p.m. to reinstall the bridge. The causeway is expected to reopen to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians by 8 p.m. Here are some road closures to be aware of. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Demare Street, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill is closed from April 22nd to May 2nd for servicing works. Russell Street, Patrick to Kent is closed April 23rd and 24th from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. for sanitary sewer line repairs. Victoria Street, Union Street to Johnson Street is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other relevant delays. Accommodation Road, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work around the newly installed culvert at the north end of Accommodation Road. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency, and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Hello everyone, my name is Henry, CFRC intern from the Department of History. We're going through this week's concerts and events calendars. On Wednesday, Whiskey Smoke will be playing a gig at the Buckle starting at 7:30. Hotel Wolf Island will also be running its usual open mic night from 8:30 to 11:30. Also on Wednesday, the Kingston Grand, as part of their Grand On Stage series, will have performers of the Classic Albums Live Concert Series playing the Fleetwood Mac album Rumours. This performance starts at 7:30 p.m. with tickets available on the Grand's website for around between $44 and $55. Frank Ryan is also scheduled to play Wednesday night between 8 and 11 at Musiki. On Thursday, Trailer Swift Band will be playing at the Buckle from 8 to 11 p.m. The Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain is scheduled to perform at the Isabel Bader at 7:30 Thursday evening. Tickets for said performance are available for between $15 and $35 on the Isabel's website. Also on Thursday, three bands, B.A. Johnston, Owl Farm, and The Strange Happenings, will be playing at the Mansion. Tickets for the show, starting at 9 p.m., are available for around $10 on Ticketscene or for $15 at the door. The Toucan also has some live performers lined up for Thursday night, with Sarah Jane Riley and Dylan Ireland performing from 9:10 to 1 as part of their Rules for the Collective Good tour. After that, on Friday, band Cheyenne Twink will be playing a concert at the Broom Factory. The show, starting at 7:30, has tickets available on Ticketscene for around $25. Also on Friday, the blues/rock group Hellhound Trail will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8 p.m. On Saturday, Frank Ryan is on to play a set or two at Tiernanog from 7 to 9. The Boo Radley Project will also be returning to the Toucan Saturday night for a show running from 10:30 to 2. Also Saturday night, the Marion Drexler Band will be playing at the RCHA starting at 8. On Sunday, Neil Carter will be performing a collection of classics at Spearhead Brewery from 2 to 5. And later on, Savannah Shea will be playing at Musiki from 4:30 to 6:30. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Again, I'm Henry, CFRC intern for the Department of History. We're continuing with today's concert and events calendars. On Wednesday, folks can head down to Musiki, which is hosting its weekly life drawing event. Don't forget to bring your own art supplies and $5 and participate in uninstructed life drawing. Also on Wednesday, One Eye Jacks will be hosting Board Game Night starting at 7, and both Something in the Water and Daft Brewing will be hosting their trivia nights, both starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, Daft will host Queerioki from 8 to 11. Folks can also head to the Kingston Public Market, which is open from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. The Kingston Spring Night Market will also be running at Memorial Center from 4 to 8 p.m. Also on Thursday, the Out in Front Weekly Run Group will be hosting its usual public run this Thursday, starting downtown at 6:15 p.m. in front of Runner's Choice. All people are invited regardless of ability, sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. On Friday, the Buckle and Daft Brewing will both be hosting their weekly free karaoke nights. Doors open at 9. On Saturday, Queen's PhD students will be giving a free talk in Ellis Hall at 7:30 p.m. The talk is open to the public, free, and will be followed by a tour of the Queen's Observatory. Folks can also head down to participate in Runner's Choice East End Run Group at 7:50 a.m. at the Canets Kingston Supermart, 29 Niagara Park. The Kingston Public Market also runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Sunday, the Runner's Choice Lawn Run starts downtown outside their store at 8:20 a.m. All ages and paces are welcome. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 1 p.m. at Memorial Center. Do you have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concerts and events calendars? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at cfrcmusic on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. I have been Henry, CFRC intern for the Queen's Department of History, and this has been my last broadcast of the concert and events calendars updates. Someone else will be taking over soon. I hope everyone listening has a nice summer. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Today on Wings.
You see, we are the unsung heroes. Journalists are the unsung heroes. We go out there, we tell stories of other people's.
Sophie Njoka is a journalist in Mombasa, Kenya, and a co-founder of the organization Article 27, which includes female journalists and women human rights defenders. She was interviewed by longtime Wings correspondent Diana Wanyonyi.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
My name is Sophie Njoka. I'm a journalist based here in Mombasa, Coast Region. I'm a practicing journalist currently with the mainstream media. I'm passionate about human rights, especially in terms of gender equality and also in terms of violations that usually target women in our society.
Who is Sophie? Can you just give me a background about Sophie, your education, your family, then what gave you passion to join journalism?
For someone who doesn't know about Sophie, I'm the third born in a family of six. Mainly we are women, so I've grown up in a setup of women. That is why I've embraced womanhood up to now where I am, because I do not know, growing up surrounded by women, I do not know how it feels to be a man. That is why I've embraced womanhood. I'm a degree holder from the University of Nairobi. And also, I'm a mother to two lovely boys. By the way, back in school, I didn't want to major in journalism. I just became passionate about writing. I've done procurement. I just became passionate about writing after a close relative introduced me into journalism. And that is how I found myself in the newsroom. I'm not a trained journalist, but where I am, where I sit from, I've done short courses in matters journalism. Mm-hmm.
What kind of stories do you do, and how many years have you been active in journalism?
I've been an active journalist for the past 8 years. This is my ninth year, come to the end of this year. And I'm passionate about human interest stories. I've been a court reporter before. Even currently, I'm still practicing as a court reporter. I do gender stories. I also do other areas like crime. I've majored in crime. I usually do crime reporting. I also do environment and health stories.
Can you tell us one of your best stories that you still remember?
I have several. I've done several stories that brought major breakthroughs. You see, as a reporter from where I sit from, whenever I see breakthroughs in those stories that we are telling, I know that I am one in my small way. I've told stories about gay population, which is a newborn baby in our country right now. It's a bit a very sensitive area up to now. No one wants to speak about it, but I've brought changes in this area, even in enabling a person who was a gay man get treatment at the Coast General Hospital.
If coverage of gay rights is a newborn baby in Kenya, reporter Sophie Njoka has been one of its midwives. Article 27 of the Kenyan Constitution guarantees equality and freedom from discrimination. But living up to that promise is another matter. Sophie is active in a group comprised of female journalists and human rights defenders, whom she calls HRD for short, and that is where she got the lead for a story that changed a life.
We have a small network that includes of female journalists and women HRD, where we share stories. And someone, a woman HRD in that network, shared a story about a gay man who had been declined treatment by the virtue of him being gay. So he had been sodomized previously.
Here in Mombasa?
Yes, within Mombasa. He had been sodomized very badly, and he required a P3 for him to prosecute the case. So when he went to the Gender Recovery Center for him to be assisted, there was no one to attach to him, having the perception that we do not have any way of treating gay men. So when the story was raised up in the network, I picked up with the victim, and he was able to explain to me that he has been at the hospital for the first, second, and third day. No treatment had been offered unto him. So what I did is I called a nurse at the same hospital and asked him, could you perhaps facilitate the treatment of this man? He's a victim who has been sodomized. He's in pain. He also needs P3 form for him to prosecute the case. And that is how he got treatment. He managed to get treatment and also get the P3 form. And that is how now the perpetrators were able to be arrested.
Now, Sophie, can you tell us about organization that you're working with? How did it come about?
I am the Secretary General of Article 27. It is an organization that is inclusive of female journalists and women HRDs. We are based here at the Coast Region. And how we came about the organization is that when COVID hit, there were no sources of news because everyone was required to work back at home. But you remember at that particular time, there were so many increased violations. Cases of gender-based violence were on the increase while everyone had retreated back home. So these cases were being raised. However, there was no clear channel of who had been abused, who has been violated. So we, as the founder, as one of the founders, we gathered six women. I remember I was the only journalist and other women human rights defenders drawn from Coast Region, and they said, see here, look here, we have to find a way of telling these stories. There is an increase of abuse of children, men and both women. How do we come up together? So we decided, let us form a WhatsApp group where we can share up these cases. In the formation of the WhatsApp group, we also added key government agencies, officials, representatives of various organizations who would also make our work easier. For instance, so-and-so had been reported to have been beaten somewhere within Mombasa. So the case has been reported there by a certain human rights defender. How do we come to the rescue of that specific person? We have to involve police officers to come for that person, be rescued, either be taken to a safe house or the case be prosecuted. And that is how we found that we had formed the Article 27. We are at 2 years. End of this year, we'll be celebrating our third year. The important role, you see, we are the unsung heroes. Journalists are the unsung heroes. We go out there, we tell stories of other peoples. And in the initial formation of the network, we thought it twice to include journalists in a way that they would amplify the injustices that were ongoing in our society. By how? By telling out these stories as so-and-so rights had been violated. Also, we've turned besides from telling the stories of others, we've also turned the network to be a safe space where if I'm beaten, I'm unable to tell my own story. If my own rights are violated, I'm unable to tell my own story. So there is that woman HRD in that specific group in our network who will pick my story and amplify my voice on my own behalf and say, see, Sophie's rights have been violated. So what do we do? Do we protest? Do we demonstrate for her also to get justice?
Sophie was asked if what their group is doing might be dangerous. She uses the term GBV in her answer, short for gender-based violence.
So security-wise, we've undergone several trainings in terms of GBV matters where we know if you are the victim, if Sophie is the victim, there are areas of her life that I'm not supposed to disclose even to the public. There are areas where we have code of conducts for our members where you are required to sign. It's like taking an oath where you shouldn't tell Sophie was abused by her husband on a certain day, despite me having disclosed that. You know what? This is what I'm going through. I also have a GBV case in my home, but you do not go speaking that Sophie has done so. In our code of conduct, we know the aspect of not revealing the name of the victim.
Next, interviewer Diana Wanyonyi asks about gender-based violence experienced by women journalists on the job.
How true is it about issues about gender-based violence in newsrooms, in media houses in Kenya? Do you have any experience and what should be done?
A very gray area right now, even as I speak. I know the reason why we need to fight for female journalists in the newsroom in terms of sexual harassment. I just decided it is very prudent. However, journalists are unable to speak by themselves. I know myself, what made me speak is having witnessed myself being abused by a colleague. No one spoke about me. And it reached a time when I decided enough is enough. These things are ongoing within our newsrooms. But by the virtue of us having male bosses, the sexual harassment will still continue. Because you go report to a male boss that so-and-so has abused my rights as a woman, but the response from them is not appealing at all, at all. Him being a man, my boss being a man, and the person who has already abused me being a man, they'll try to cover up for each other. So we came up with ways of confidentially finding ways and mechanisms of reporting these cases among us journalists. Right now, currently, we are dealing with several cases where journalists have been abused, and we are trying to carry out awareness. You are there to work, just like your fellow male journalist. We are there to work. We are not there to be used as sexual objects. We are there to work, do our work, and I'm not there for you to sexualize my body or sexualize me while I'm working.
Can you tell us about your story? What happened?
I remember it's right now, this is the fourth year, very fresh dates in my mind. A new colleague had come from Nairobi, and I was walking to the washroom. He was leaving the washroom, and from nowhere, he just touched my breast. So I was kind of surprised because it was quite inappropriate of him to touch my breast. He just grabbed my breast with his hand and touched me. So I was shocked. In that moment, I just took my back behind and asked him, "What have you just done?" Mm. Then for him, it was like he had done nothing. So I provoked him and asked him, "What have you done?" Because now, what I'm doing, the next step that I'm taking, I will write to my bosses. I raised the same grievances of my boss having touched my breast with my immediate boss. And my immediate boss said, "Let me consult." Then upon consultation, he told me I should do an official communication to my bosses. That aggrieved me. And by being aggrieved by that, I went even to report to the police station. The matter was reported at the gender desk, but unfortunately, the suspect was moved from the office where I am based to another office. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what was the reaction? Did you maybe talk to other female colleagues about your situation, maybe to know if the same perpetrator did similar thing to other journalists?
Funny enough, I did not keep quiet, and I never kept quiet. I wouldn't have held my peace. And funny enough, when I spoke to my my female colleagues whom I work with at the office, they also raised the same issues of him having harassed women in the newsroom sexually. It was a regular habit for him to do so. And they did raise it so much, but with no proper mechanism in the newsroom even to report cases of sexual harassment. The story just died a natural death. No one was pursued. It was just even made the talk, the joke of the office, that you see so-and-so has been harassing women in this office sexually. But no action was really taken at the office. And I remember one young woman who is younger than me, and I truly did pity her. And when we were to reconcile the cases where he had sexually assaulted, the suspect had sexually assaulted several women, the young women said, but I'm not ready to undergo all this drama. I'm not ready to undergo, to remember what he did to me. I've already held peace with what he did to me, and I've not confronted him, but I'll never speak to him again because I know that he's a sex predator in the office, and that is how it ended.
In your own words, why is it that it's difficult for women journalists to speak up openly about this sexual harassment?
We lack awareness. We've not been sensitized on what you should do as a woman, especially once you face a case of sexual harassment. Even me, myself, when I joined where I work, I was not told that no one should harass you. We do not even sign, we do not have even any clear guidelines on once you are harassed in the newsroom, where do you report? What should you do? There are no clear mechanism even for women to tell their stories. And also another thing that I've witnessed in the newsroom is that we've normalized being sexually molested. We've normalized. We just take it as normal that Sophie was sexually harassed. It is because she has big boobs. It is because she wore a revealing top. It is because of her body structure. No, that person who is harassing you is the same person who is out there harassing other women, but we don't have any clear guidelines even on how should I report once I'm sexually molested. There are no clear guidelines in the newsroom. And men feel superior that us as female journalists in the newsroom, we are like, we are not there to work. We are there to please them. We are there to be sexualized. That is where we go wrong as female journalists. However, in our network, we are championing and advocating for women's rights. No one should sexually molest you. You're there to work, just like your female counterpart. You're there to do any type of job that your male counterpart can deliver. We are here to work. So treat us as your colleagues and not like sexual objects.
On Wings, you are listening to Kenyan news reporter Sophie Njoka speaking to Wings contributing producer Diana Wanyonyi. Aside from harassment, Njoka sees women journalists being overlooked for promotion and tending to be ghettoized into covering certain types of stories.
In the newsroom, the bigger roles, the tough roles are for men. Us as women, we are seen, we are taken for the softer roles, which is not contrary to today's world. And you see again, in terms of promotion, you find that you have the required grades to get promoted easily, but since you're a woman who will in a few months go for your maternity leave, you've been stagnant in that job group for quite some time. The reason, mostly our bosses tend to promote men whom they perceive stronger for certain roles rather than us women who can also equally perform the same roles that they think that men can better than us. Mm. Yes.
Here's how Sophie deals with that.
I've been covering crime, which is male-dominated right now.
Here are some of the topics Sophie Joka has covered related to women. Efforts underway to arrest more suspects in Mombasa bloggers' rape ordeal. Sex workers down tools to protest surge in femicide. Thousands of sex workers drawn from the coast region have downed their tools in protest of increased cases of femicide in the country. Court orders police to charge businessman arrested for conning dozens of women. A human rights group has now moved to the High Court in Mombasa, seeking orders to compel investigative agencies to launch a probe into the generation of post-rape care forms at the Gender-Based Violence Recovery Center in the Coast General Teaching and Referral Hospital. Court directs co-wives to forgive each other after brawl. Man in court for calling his neighbor a prostitute. Woman cries for justice after being assaulted by an American man multiple times. Diana Wanyonyi next asked Sophie Njoka some probing questions about how the Article 27 group, which is comprised of female journalists and human rights defenders, supports the problems of its own journalist members in Kenya.
We have a membership of 15 journalists and a total membership of 60 members. Both female journalists and women HRD. We've trained them in various areas, economic empowerment, fentership. How can I fenter you into becoming a better person?
What is that?
It's in terms of fentership is I am senior than you, so how did you get there to that seniority position? It's equally the same name as mentorship. Yes, but for us, we refer to it as mentorship. Economic empowerment. Don't be dependent on your employer only. Get a side hustle. Get something else to do besides being employed as a journalist. We've also trained them in terms of both physical and digital training, where mostly we emphasize on the security of a journalist. We always tell our members, no story is worth your life. No story is worth your life. So if you see there is a risk there, know how to maneuver and get out of that risk, safely.
Apart from security and cybercrime, what else have you trained at this journalist?
We've also trained them in terms of reporting cases of sexual harassment. We are working closely with various government agencies, the judiciary, the police, in terms of reporting these cases. Also for easy access in terms of hiding somebody's identity if you do not want your identity to be revealed.
Let's talk about mental health. There are so many things that's going around in the world, especially for us journalists. You know, we talk and air about other people's problem issues, but no one talks about us. We also have our own issues. Now, can you speak about the aspect of mental health to journalists and also their psychological support if there's a problem? Because after COVID, many journalists lost their jobs. Now, how do you go about it in your organization?
We also have an aspect of mental training where we debrief. We have trained counselors as some of our members attached to some of the major institutions in the country, where when you feel you are at the verge of having a breakdown, you can anytime, they are readily available in the WhatsApp group. In the official, we have a separate official group where we feel, this is a case where we feel that you should be attended to urgently. What we usually do, we discuss it in the separate official groups. Then we assign that specific person who is our member, a counselor in the group. We have government-trained counselors in our group where we allocate anyone who feels the need to undergo psychosocial support, mental support. We also do debriefing. Three times yearly, we say, now, let us go out, celebrate ourselves, have fun and also debrief and tell how it has been. And anyone who had any a mental case was also seen by the counselors. And in case you need a follow-up also, they'll also do the same.
For free?
Yes, for free. We usually do it for free.
And how was the turnout?
We usually accord priority to our members, our registered members. Mm-hmm. We were about 30, those who went to Atamu.
And do you think after that session, are there some changes?
Of course. Women are out there doing their work with a lot of energy. Women are out there doing what they're supposed to do for the society with a lot of energy. And for those cases, the few cases that we had, and we saw that there is need for them to be attended more, they're still going on with the counseling and with their sessions. Yes. But so far, so good. We are good to go for the year. And we are okay to perform our duties.
For example, for a journalist who has lost her job, how can you help?
We do help, especially we have a member who lost her job last year. She was sacked moments after she was done reading the news.
Sophie says their organization liaised with Kituo cha Sheria, Kenya's national nonprofit legal advice center.
We liaised with Kituo cha Sheria to see how her employer would make payments for her. And we consulted other organizations to move in for us. The case is now right before court. And so far, so good. She's being helped where it is required. It wouldn't have been made easy if we didn't join hands with women HRDs out there who have shown us even solidarity with cases that we have to fight this monster in the newsroom. With cases of women being violated, they come up in large numbers in courts, even at police stations, just to be our voice. In that situation, you're very vulnerable and a very voiceless journalist.
Are you planning as an organization to expand this to other parts of Kenya?
Of course, yes. We are still a young organization right now. Currently, we are a registered organization. Most of our activities were being funded by the Protect Project, which came to an end last year in November. We are also working with other organizations to see how we shall source for funds and also extend our arms into other counties where there are female journalists also. And we are looking into the possibility of increasing the number of membership in terms of female journalists and even for women human rights defenders to join us across the country.
This group is known as Article 27, referring to a section of the Kenyan Constitution. Six pillars of Article 27 of the Kenya Constitution include 1. Equality before the law. Every person is equal in the eyes of the law and has the right to be treated fairly. 2. Equal protection and benefit of the law. Everyone is entitled to the same legal protection and advantages. 3. Equal enjoyment of all rights. This includes the right to freedom of speech, assembly, religion, and movement, among others, regardless of sex or gender. 4. Equal treatment for women and men. Both men and women are entitled to equal opportunities in all spheres, including political, economic, cultural, and social. 5. Prohibition of discrimination. The state and individuals are prohibited from discriminating against any person on the basis of their race, sex, ethnicity, religion, or any other protected characteristic. 6. Affirmative action. The state can take measures, including affirmative action programs, to address past discrimination and ensure equal access to opportunities for those who have been historically disadvantaged.
These are the six pillars where we base our organization on, and these are the pillars that should self-drive this organization to the next level. Worldwide, in Africa especially, let us arm ourselves. Let us join our hearts and have one voice where we can amplify on us to stop being sexually molested in the newsroom. Let us not normalize that. Let us not make it normal for us to be sexually molested because of the virtue of being a woman. No, let us join hearts and stop it by calling out those who are our molesters.
Sophie Njoka is a journalist in Mombasa, Kenya, and a co-founder of the organization Article 27, which includes female journalists and women human rights defenders. She was interviewed by longtime Wings correspondent Diana Wanyonyi. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in